It is clear that in appropriate cases, endocrine therapy and trastuzumab are important elements of systemic adjuvant therapy. But there are some patients who will not benefit from either trastuzumab or endocrine therapy. Let's meet Marta, one of Dr. Carlson's patients, who was diagnosed with hormone receptor negative, HER2 negative breast cancer.
Life was a lot of fun. My husband and I had just gotten married, and we spent a lot of time traveling. We both worked really hard. We had very demanding jobs. It was a pretty full life, but we were having a lot of fun. I found out about the lump really unexpectedly. I went to my gynecologist for my annual exam, and she found the lump. She told me that, you know, it was very common for women my age to have lumps in their breasts, that 80% of them are benign. The next step for us was to go to a breast surgeon. She suggested that I actually go get a mammogram to take a look at what was actually in the lump. My decision ultimately was to go ahead and take the entire lump out of my breast. We were considering having children at that point, and one of the concerns was that if you leave it there, it's very difficult to continue to monitor it. And frankly, they removed it, and we sort of expected at that point that I was done. So I was a little surprised when the surgeon called me and told me that, in her words, there was a little cancer in the lump that they removed. I was 33 when I was diagnosed. They said, you know, women of your age really rarely get breast cancer.
I was out of town on business, 2,000 miles away from home, when Marta learned of her diagnosis, and it was absolutely shocking. And we, of course, at that point, didn't have the details to fully understand what lay ahead for us. But we knew that this was a very serious thing and would change our lives forever.
When they did the excisional biopsy, they came away with clean margins. But it also was node negative, which essentially meant that it was entirely out of my body, at least as far as they knew. It was relatively small, so it was stage one, which was encouraging. We were told that it was a triple negative tumor. It didn't really mean anything to us other than it meant that there were some options for treatment that weren't available. But to give me the best possible long-term outcome, that some mixture of chemotherapy and radiation was probably appropriate. The hardest part of making the decision to have chemotherapy was the concern about the impact that it might have to my fertility. We were right at the point as a couple where we decided that we wanted to have a family. While I was in treatment, I essentially went through temporary menopause. A couple of months into the chemotherapy, my period stopped. Some women might consider that a blessing for somebody of childbearing age. It was really spooky to just know that your body was being impacted that traumatically by the chemotherapy. It's sort of a strange process in the sense that you get treated, you feel really bad for a period of several days, and just when you're starting to feel like you're on the upswing, they hit you again with the next treatment. Going through chemo was the absolute slowest summer of my entire life. Radiation was less difficult because it doesn't have nearly as comprehensive an impact on your body. It's a local treatment, so it's really about the breast and the area that was found to have cancer. Several months after I finished treatment, my period started again. After I finished radiation, I got on my bike and started riding. We slowly built up. We went out, you know, multiple times a week, and we would go out for long rides. I wanted to go out and do a century ride, essentially do the Ride for the Roses, which is a 100-mile bike ride. It was a great motivator for me, and the fantastic thing about that ride is that, you know, a lot of the people who choose to do it are survivors. Day after, we were stunned to find out that I was actually pregnant during the ride. I was 2 weeks along, and so we celebrated. She came a month early, so we didn't know what we were going to name her the day that she was born. We ultimately decided to name her Mira. We named her after the miracle that we think that she is. I think in many cases we are more enamored with and in love with our daughter than many parents are, and that's saying a lot because I know everybody loves their kids. we love her just a little bit more, I think, because we were faced with the possibility that we might never have her.
Well, Marta's story certainly brings home to us what is so important about what we're about today. She had a estrogen receptor negative, progesterone receptor negative, HER2 negative breast cancer, the so-called triple negative breast cancer. And that's a difficult subset of breast cancers to treat because you cannot use endocrine therapies because of the negative estrogen and progesterone receptors. And trastuzumab is presumably not of value because of the HER2 negativity. And that really leaves us with cytotoxic chemotherapy. We also need to look at patients like Marta and individualize their treatment and individualize their prognosis. In women with larger triple negative breast cancers, the triple negative status is actually an adverse prognostic factor. Marta fortunately had a small node negative, triple negative breast cancer, and so her overall prognosis is actually relatively favorable. Nonetheless, her risk of recurrence was felt high enough that she did receive cytotoxic chemotherapy. And there are different types of cytotoxic chemotherapy that may be of greater benefit than others in women such as hers. She actually was treated with the Dose-Dense AC followed by paclitaxel regimen.
Here's a group of breast cancers that we're defining not by what they are, essentially, but by what they're not. And I think that this leaves open a very important science question for us, which is, are triple-negative breast cancers one distinct entity, or are they a collection of breast cancers that share the traits of no expression of estrogen and progesterone receptor and no expression of HER2 or limited expression? Developing targeted therapies for this subtype of breast cancer presumes that there is a unifying target, and that may not be the case. We'll have to see how this plays out.
We are exploring other avenues of biologics in patients with tumors that are triple negative, which comprise about 15% of all breast cancers. And the goal is to try to look for common other molecular pathways that can be targeted. And there's one such study that's ongoing now looking at the role of inhibiting angiogenesis in the adjuvant setting in a randomized trial. But there are many other studies at phase 1 and phase 2 levels looking at other pathways that can be targeted to potentially enhance the benefit of chemotherapy in these patients with triple negative tumors.
Well, although cytotoxic chemotherapy can increase disease-free survival, loss of fertility is one potential side effect. Marta, the patient we met earlier, had this to say.
We agonized over whether it made sense for me to pursue chemotherapy and put my fertility at risk. And we decided that that was the best course of action, that I wanted to be as healthy as possible and have the best odds possible, and that that was going to be important not only for me and my family, but also hopefully for any children that we might ultimately have.
So Marta brings up a very important point, and after long discussion with Dr. Carlson, she obviously chose to proceed with adjuvant chemotherapy, being fully aware of the risk of potential infertility after chemotherapy in a premenopausal woman. And the factors that increase the risk of infertility for patients who are premenopausal and undergo chemotherapy include the age of the patient. So the younger the age, the less the chance of becoming infertile post-chemotherapy. And the older the patient, the higher the risk. So most patients after age 40 are unlikely to resume their menses and become amenorrheic. The other factor is the chemotherapy, so some chemotherapies have a higher risk of infertility than others. In addition, there's lots of retrospective data showing it's perfectly safe to become pregnant after diagnosis of breast cancer and treatment for breast cancer, that does not decrease one's prognosis or decrease one's survival. So I think she made a very educated decision in discussion with Dr. Carlson regarding her risks of her breast cancer recurrence, her survival, and her fertility.
Well, it's clear that testing for biomarkers is essentially really important in making these treatment decisions. And we've talked about HER2 testing. What about hormone receptor testing? How accurate are these tests?
Estrogen and progesterone receptor testing is actually performed so that we can identify patients who may benefit from endocrine manipulations. That's the goal of the testing. And when we talk about accuracy, it's important to highlight that that's actually the benchmark. It's not necessarily who actually has or doesn't have the estrogen receptor. Really what we care about is who is responsive to endocrine therapies. I just point that out because there's a lot of discussion about whether these tests are accurate or not. And I think we have to reframe the discussion. Our goal is to not miss a patient who might potentially benefit from therapy. Now, there are some data that are concerning in that regard. A retrospective analysis of an old duct carcinoma in situ trial performed by Craig Allred show that when centrally retested, up to 20% of the specimens that had been labeled estrogen receptor negative in local communities were in fact at least weakly positive. So this raises the possibility that those patients might benefit at least to some degree from hormone therapy, and those are the patients we obviously don't want to miss. There's another nuance to this discussion, which is that while we typically call hormone receptor results positive or negative, that really misses the issue, which is that there's a grade of positivity. And probably buried within the group we call positive are subsets that benefit a lot from endocrine therapy, subsets that benefit not so much, and maybe subsets that really don't benefit at all. We're approaching that right now biologically when we do molecular phenotyping of breast cancer via genomic testing. And with that, we identify so-called luminal A and B breast cancers that are maybe more and less responsive to endocrine therapy. So there are times when we get estrogen receptor and progesterone receptor results, especially negatives, that just don't fit with what we anticipated. And I think in those situations, we may want to think about retesting. And I wonder what Lori and Bob do in terms of retesting.
So as Cliff said, we don't want to miss an opportunity to treat a patient who may benefit from hormonal therapy. And the classical patient from whom I might want to repeat the ER and PR is a postmenopausal patient with a small tumor that's well differentiated, and the outside ER PR comes back negative. Because we know that in older women, the ERs and PRs tend to be higher or more positive than in younger women. And for those patients where really a simple therapy with hormonal therapy may make a world of difference in terms of both benefit and quality of life, I would not want to miss that opportunity. So in those patients, I would definitely repeat the ER and PR.
This is all very helpful information for practitioners, and this is a good time to remind you that physicians and other healthcare professionals can earn free CME credit by registering online at discoveryhealthcme.com and taking the post-test. All the graphics and references from today's program will also be available online. It's easy, so do it today and earn free CME credit. Now, in addition to tumor characteristics, what about the patient herself? Should older patients be treated differently than younger patients?
That's a very important question, especially if the demographics in the U.S. really reveal to us that we have an increasingly aging population of patients. So this question will come up more and more. And breast cancer is a disease of older postmenopausal women. But the definition of age is really important to define, and one has to really think of physiologic age, not chronological age. And this takes into account the patient's performance status, their comorbidities, their toxicities from treatment with other medications for other diseases and organ function. And all of that needs to be taken into consideration as well as their chronological age. Now, the guidelines actually represent the data from the Oxford Overview, which suggests that chemotherapy may not be as beneficial in older women compared to younger women. But there are some limitations in that data because from the Oxford Overview, there's very little data for patients who are older than 70 in all of those randomized trials. But for the most part, they weren't even eligible for those randomized trials. So we really don't have any data. So the best we can do is really look at the patient's physiological age and extrapolate what we know about younger women and really have the patient participate in the decision-making process. And for the younger physicians, the answer on the boards is not to utilize age discrimination, that the standard of care for middle-aged women is the same as for older women.
Another dimension to this issue is that patient preference may change across age, the spectrum of age, so that older women may have different goals in life. They may be less accepting of toxicity or discomfort in their future than a 20 or 30-year-old woman would be, for instance.
It seems one could easily be overwhelmed by all the different considerations involved in planning systemic adjuvant therapy. And I understand that there is this online tool, Adjuvant Online, that's available. How can that help oncologists pull all the information together?
Yeah, I find this as a tool that not only helps the oncologist, but actually is very helpful for the patients also, because when you go into this website, you can print out a patient version as well as a physician version. And it includes data that one plugs in regarding the tumor characteristics, so the size, and the grade and the estrogen receptor status, as well as the patient's characteristics as far as age and comorbidities, and then looks at different regimens to determine what the advantages of adding hormonal therapy and the advantage of adding additional chemotherapy, and comes out with some numbers that are really in a graphic way that can really help patients and physicians decide together whether the patient's goals are met and whether they should proceed with adjuvant therapy. So this is a pretty useful tool, and it's an evolving tool. Dr. Rapton does continue to modify this tool as there's more data available.
We've had a very thorough discussion today. We've covered indications for systemic adjuvant therapy, predictive and prognostic factors, estrogen receptor and HER2 status, the use of endocrine therapy, targeted therapy, and cytotoxic therapy, as well as considerations for individual patients. So, doctors, how would you summarize all the material that we've covered today?
Well, I'd start by saying that for most women with newly diagnosed breast cancer, that the use of systemic adjuvant therapy can substantially improve overall disease-free survival as well as overall survival.
Most patients who get adjuvant therapy can lead mostly normal lives throughout the entire course of therapy. And after all, the goal is to lead a normal life then and beyond. So I think that people should be reassured by that. And I have to add, the falling death rate that Lori introduced at the beginning of the talk actually has to be put up against a rising incidence of breast cancer, at least until recently. And so the gains that have been made through the broad and even-handed application of these adjuvant systemic treatments, I think, are substantial from a public health point of view.
And I want to also emphasize that we've been talking about individualized therapy based on the biology of the tumor. So we look forward to future research determining other pathways and tumor markers and proper measurements and new therapeutic strategies to treat breast cancer.
In closing, I'd like to thank each of you for participating in this extremely important conversation today about systemic adjuvant therapy for early breast cancer. And I'd also like to thank you, our viewers, and hope the discussion today will be helpful in advising your patients and making the best treatment decisions. Also, I encourage each of you to go to your computer, log on to discoveryhealthcme.com, and take the post-test. It only takes a few minutes to earn free CME credit for watching this program. And if you'd like to see the program again, you can watch it online, download a podcast, or order a DVD. The slides and references from the program are also available online. Finally, I'd like to thank the National Comprehensive Cancer Network for accrediting the program. And once again, you can download their guidelines at nccn.org. I'd like to thank our supporters, Bristol-Myers Squibb, Genentech, Novartis, and Pfizer. For Discovery Health, I'm Maria Blakey. See you next time on Discovery Health CME. A lot of greetings.